Good afternoon, dear colleagues. We had a very nice discussion in a workshop, workshop number one, on mutual international cooperation, and two main conclusions. First, the setup of 5 to 6 persons is ideal. We have very good exchange, very open. People are really willing to speak. And the second conclusion, 1 hour to discuss this topic is not sufficient. We had really good discussion, and I would like to thank an open audience to the participants of workshop one for that. We had a discussion based on a case which I yesterday briefly presented, namely the case on labor exploitation. And we used this as a basis for discussion on some particular aspects of the mutual cooperation. First, we discussed practical experience with Eurojust, Europol, or what is the experience when it comes to the cooperation with police liaison officers. The participants confirmed awareness of Eurojust or the other institutions I just mentioned. What was highlighted is the importance of police-to-police cooperation and direct contacts among the police officers. So the international cooperation is not, definitely doesn't start at the level of judicial involvement in the proceedings, however, starts much sooner, already in the pretrial procedure or before the formal investigations are somehow initiated. When we discussed practical experience with JIS, again, participants confirmed their awareness of this instrument. However, practical experience were not confirmed. When we had very open discussion on the pros and cons of joint investigation teams, I believe we agreed that positives are definitely there. However, when considering entering into JITs, one has to be really aware also of some potential risks which might those joint investigation teams generate. We had identified one particular aspect, namely access of defense lawyers to the files. If this is done due to the obligation stemming out of the particular legislation in one country, in a phase when, for example, in another country, the parallel proceedings is pending and is still in the very, very, very restricted phase, it might significantly hinder such investigations, naturally. So it's very important prior to an agreement, whether or not to sign joint investigation team agreement, really to openly discuss with our potential partners all the possible aspects. And as a good basis for this discussion, participants confirmed that Eurojust might be used for. When it comes to cooperation with third countries, and in comparison to cooperation with EU countries, generally we can say that cooperation within the European Union works faster than with third countries. It's hardly possible to get assistance from some countries in Africa, for example. However, it's difficult to generalize some very good examples of cooperation with Russia. Latvian participants confirm very good cooperation in this respect. Some examples of good cooperation with South America countries, namely with Venezuela, were also highlighted. Again, in that respect, Eurojust might be used as a facilitator, just to mention. Good cooperation thanks to the Spanish and Portuguese national desks and their not only historical but also present contacts with South America countries, which are used and very, very beneficial. We also slightly touch other aspects of cooperation with JITs. Participants were again aware of the financial support which can be provided by Eurojust to the investigative measures taken by the joint investigation teams. we also slightly touched the potential question of conflicts of jurisdiction. And again, we came to a conclusion, nothing which perhaps would be a surprise, that it's important to talk and take into consideration all aspects of the particular cases. It's difficult to generalize, however, indeed, case-to-case discussion is needed and several aspects have to be taken into consideration, like even the rate of punishment and expectations of punishment. Not to mention, not to forget, we also came to a point of resources available for investigations. And that's the reality. I think that's the case in more national jurisdictions, that financial restrictions and crisis impacted also budgets of law enforcement and prosecution offices, and simply some cases might not be developed as perhaps they would deserve if more resources were available. This is the reality, and again, when having open and frank discussion with partners abroad, this problem should be highlighted and make your partners aware of all the challenges. So once again, we thank you very much for very good exchange we had in the meeting, and likewise the discussion, direct one we had in the meeting. That's perhaps the general advice for the international cooperation, simply to talk to your partners. Thank you.
Hello. It was my pleasure to moderate the Mediterranean workshop with representatives of Spain, Portugal, and Greece. And we worked on the grounds of a real case. So what we did was work on this case. I'm going to summarize, and then I'll give you the report. It's a case of a possible human trafficking from women from Paraguay to Spain, and the case was dismissed. We were not able to prosecute the case, so I want you to know this for sure. Through intelligence information, police officers, Spanish police officers, get to know of a possible case of sexual exploitation under slavery conditions. The police contact the informant, reports that several women from Latin America are exploited in a big nightclub in the south of Spain. Police officer pay a visit to the nightclub on account of immigration control and do not gather any evidence because no one wants to say anything. And so they initiate another investigation. I want to say that working as a prostitute in Spain is not illegal, and pimping is not illegal either, so no arrest was made. But taking into account the reliable intelligence information, a more specific investigation was conducted by the Spanish police officer. So they get to know that there would be a case of money laundering, given that the trafficker, the suspect, and his wife kept high bank accounts and run several legal persons related to tourism business, and they maintain a standard of living not related to any known legal job. Besides, they were able to identify two travel agencies in Paraguay, which was supposedly involved in the recruitment of possible victims of human trafficking to bring to Spain to work as prostitutes. We have more information, and what the police did was to ask the judge for a tape warrant, and the investigating judge denied the telephone intervention. The lack of enough indicators and the few reliable information was taken into account to make this decision, So far, no victim has been detected. So the judge pointed out in this decision that there was lack of evidences to consider a proportionality to between the tape, the tapware, and the crime, and the fundamental rights of the perpetrator. Then the police officer decided to pay a second visit to the nightclub to find some of the suspected victims and potential victims and to arrest the perps on accounts of money laundering. But when they returned to the nightclub, the police officer returned to the nightclub, they discovered that the potential victims do not remain there anymore and have gone away. So, based in this case, we started talking about the two ways of investigating human trafficking, the proactive investigation and the reactive investigation. The difference between the reactive and the proactive investigation, as my colleagues pointed out, is that the reactive investigation is a response to a situation where the information has been received by the authorities because either the offences has been committed or there is a victim to rescue. So there is a legal duty to disrupt the investigation and to make a decision in response to a previous situation. That's a reactive investigation. The proactive investigation is the case. Can be initiated as a result of an intelligence obtained that needs further investigation, maybe through an informant, a police informant, it was the case. The objective of the investigation is to rescue the potential victims or and get evidences that will enable the arrest and prosecute the traffickers and study the modus operandi. The problem is in this proactive investigation, given that the police officers need to gather more evidences, these kind of techniques are usually intrusive to the fundamental rights of the perpetrators, searchers, tape wires, use of undercover agents, and so on. And what we discussed in the workshop was how to use these investigation techniques. It was difficult for all my colleagues to go ahead with an investigation of human trafficking based on the proactive investigation without any victim identified. So it's the first conclusion. It's not easy to go ahead with a proactive investigation for the judges in my workshop. To go ahead with intrusive techniques of investigation, a judge warrant is necessary. I'm talking about tape records and searches. However, other kinds of investigation can be used by the police without a warrant. It's a case of controlled deliveries or undercover agents in Portugal and Greece, but not in Spain. In Spain, we need a judge warrant to make a controlled delivery or use an undercover agent. We talk about the possibility of use controlled deliveries in cases of human trafficking, and the result was it was very difficult to use this kind of investigation as long as we are dealing with human beings. So trying to avoid the risk of these human beings, the control delivery is excluded in the case of human trafficking. Also, it's excluded in cases of smuggling of migrants, because my colleagues and so do I understand that control deliveries are for drug trafficking in most of the cases and not for human beings. We talk about the financial investigation, and we talk about the international cooperation to gather more evidences. And the conclusions there is a strong necessity to disseminate the tools of international cooperation, because even though these tools are known by some experts it's necessary to disseminate the information to everyone, every judges and every prosecutors. And the second conclusion was no victim, no case. Without a victim identified, we have no case of human trafficking in most of the cases. I'm not talking, we were not talking about the statement of the victim, but at least a victim identified as a human being. So no victim, very difficult case. And the third conclusion was to the importance to initiate the investigation on related crimes when it's not possible to investigate the human trafficking. Those the related crimes are money laundering, forced labor, pimping, slavery, and smuggling of migrants. With a very important difference because. Whereas in Portugal and in Greece, pimping and slavery are defined in a criminal code, in Spain, neither slavery nor pimping are considered criminal offences. So this is what happens. Thank you very much.
Like a victim of trafficking, I've been forced, coerced and deceived into giving feedback by our chair. I'm just checking which group I was in now. Oh, it's sort of statements of victims and non-punishment. So I'm not going to rehearse all of the discussions which carried on from the discussions we had before our workshop. But we came up with 5 recommendations, but also 4 challenges. In terms of the recommendations, I think we concluded that these cases should be approached on a case-by-case basis. That is, that it shouldn't be restricted to just specific types of offences. I know that some countries have got either immigration offences only, or immigration offences or prostitution-related offences. But I think as our knowledge is growing of the types of crimes that victims are involved in now, we think it should be on a case-by-case basis. Secondly, it should be the circumstances of the offence and not the offence itself. Thirdly, it should be at the discretion of either police or an immigration officer, so that on encountering a victim, maybe they're being apprehended or arrested, the police or immigration officer has got discretion to not actually arrest them or not actually take them to the police station if the circumstances are such that it's clear or obvious that they are a victim of trafficking and they've been forced to commit an offence. Secondly, it should be the prosecutor who will also exercise discretion. And so although you may have evidence that somebody has committed an offence, you've got discretion not to prosecute. And thirdly, judicial discretion. Depending on your legal system, the judge will have discretion not to allow the prosecution. The judge has discretion to stop the prosecution. The judge also has discretion to mitigate the situation, either in terms of not convicting them or not imposing a penalty. A third conclusion we came to is that getting the victim to testify or their willingness to testify against a perpetrator may be increased by not prosecuting them for the crime that they've committed. We decided that there needed to be transparent guidelines so that that those guidelines would provide all the criteria against which a decision would be taken not to prosecute somebody, but they would have to be transparent so that whichever part of the country or whichever office the decision was taken into, or the decision was taken, exactly the same criteria could be seen to have been applied. And we also felt it would be useful to share experiences of case details across member states, both for consistency in outcomes, but also that we can learn lessons. However, we also came up with some challenges. First main challenge is non-identification of the victim, particularly if they don't want to disclose that they're a victim of trafficking. I know back in the UK, quite often victims of trafficking will be identified when they're in the middle of serving a sentence. And that might be because they feel safe away from their trafficker, albeit in a sort of a prison or a youth detention centre, but then start to be able to disclose the fact that they've been trafficked and forced to commit an offence. Another area where it could be a challenge would be a judgment call on the seriousness of the case. So although you felt that, yes, they were compelled to commit an offence, it's a particularly difficult judgment call if the offence is so serious, particularly where another victim is involved. So that's another challenge. A third challenge is where there's got to be a conviction, but the judge decides not to impose a penalty, which is actually part of the directive, is non-punishment. However, non-punishment can still affect the life of a victim. So they may get a conviction, but the judge may say, I won't impose any penalty. But that conviction can affect any job opportunities in the future for that victim of trafficking, or it could also affect any asylum claim. So although it says non-punishment, that actually can still be a punishment in the longer term. And finally, taking into account any potential victims of the victim and the impact on them, should we consult them before deciding whether to not prosecute? Some particular cases we've had in England have been as a result of a victim of trafficking who've been forced to themselves become a trafficker in order to get themselves out of their own situation. And although you can understand their motive for becoming a trafficker, they are also causing great harm to other victims. And so it's a sort of a real challenge then to decide, you know, sort of do we not prosecute, do we not punish? And you know, sort of, what about the poor victim that they have actually harmed? There are conclusions.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Es priecājos, ka pienācis laiks, kad mūsu pasākums ir noslēdzies. Ja? Un man ir atlikušas tikai pavisam dažas sekundes savai uzrunai. Visiem es vēlos pateikties darba grupai, kas palika mūsu grupā un kas tiešām bija interesēt runāt par upuru aizsardzību, jo, manuprāt, tiesību sargājošām iestādēm šis nav tāds primārais jautājums, pie kā vajadzētu strādāt un par ko vajadzētu domāt. Un tomēr es biju ārkārtīgi priecīga, kad lietas, kas varbūt jums nav tik būtiskas pirmajā brīdī, galu galā, bija gan emocionāli, gan praktiski piemērojama darba grupai. Pirmais, tas, ko mēs darba grupā vēlējāmies jums parādīt, un es domāju, ka tas arī izdevās, bija parādīt reāli Latvijas pieredzi, kādā veidā notiek sadarbība atbalsta sniegšanā upuriem. Un tie, kas bija darba grupā, tie arī sadzirdēja, ka konkrēta gadījuma risināšanā jums refleksiju deva gan valsts policija, gan nevalstiskais sektors, gan arī prokuratūra. Mēs arī mazliet pieskārāmies Latvijai tik sāpīgām jautājumām, fiktīvām laulībām, bet vēršot uzmanību tomēr uz šo pašu ievainojamības situāciju, piemēram, viegla vai vidēji smaga garīga atpalicība konkrētiem cilvēkiem, personai tiek liekta brīva pārvietošanās, tā tiek spiesta darīt tās darbības, kuras netika atrunātas. Uz reālā gadījuma piemēra mēs striedām, kādā veidā konkrēta institūcija varētu konkrēti darboties. Un man ir liels prieks, ka diskusijā iesaistījās citu valstu pārstāvi, kuri izejot no savas likumdošanas gadījumā, kurā ir iesaistīta nepilngadīgā persona risināja jau pēc savas valsts likumdošanas šo te gadījumu. Līdz ar to mēs palikām pie tāda pusdarīta darba. 45 minūtes, kā teica mans kolēģis Lukaš, ir ārkārtīgs laiks, lai to izdarītu. Mēs palikām pie situācijas, kad tika atvērti kompjūteri un tika skatītā savas valsts likumdošana par to, cik tad īsti šādā gadījumā mēs varētu piespriest noziedzniekiem, lai viņi saprastu soda vardzību. Jā, es domāju, tas pēdējais teikums no mūsu puses būtu tā, ka upuru aizsardzībā var piedalīties ikviena institūcija neatkarīgi no tā, kādu pamatdarbību viņa veic. Un kā mēs tikko arī no kolēģis dzirdējām, tad ir daudz vietas, kurās mums ir jādomā par upuri. Un upuru aizsardzībai tomēr jābūt pirmajā vietā. Paldies!